From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. While Henry Ford was putting Americans on the road with his Model T, he was also preaching anti-Semitism. He used the newspaper he owned to publish excerpts of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which purported to be the minutes of a meeting of Jewish conspirators plotting to take over the world. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's just out in paperback. Also, we remember Lucy Grayley, the poet and essayist. She died last month at the age of 39. Grayley's 1994 memoir, Autobiography of a Face, was about growing up with extreme facial disfigurement from cancer and repeated surgery. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Marriage, a Duet by Ann Taylor Fleming. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. United Airlines, trying to rebuild after filing for bankruptcy, says it will lay off nearly 1,500 more management and salaried workers to help cut costs, NPR's Cheryl Corley reports.
United filed for bankruptcy nearly a month ago and is under pressure to meet specific financial objectives, or it could lose the remainder of $1.5 billion in interim financing it's received from a group of banks, allowing the airline to restructure. United has already laid off hundreds of workers. It says these new layoffs will occur by January 19th. In addition, United says it will shut down 32 remaining ticket offices in various parts of the country. That would add another 188 employees to the layoff list. In the meantime, the bankruptcy judge overseeing United's case says he'll rule next Friday on whether United can go forward with efforts to nullify collective bargaining agreements with its unions if no new contracts are in place by then. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
President Bush told soldiers at Fort Hood, Texas today that he has confidence in their abilities if he should decide to order an attack on Iraq. The president said military action would be a final option if Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein refuses to disarm, but he said U.S. troops are ready.
We're not waiting for another attack. We can't wait for another attack to employ the full power of America in this cause. We're acting now to protect the American people and to shape a future of peace.
The president also mentioned the crisis over North Korea's nuclear program, saying the world must continue to pressure the North to give up its nuclear ambitions. He said the world has already spoken with one voice to insist that Iraq give up its weapons of mass destruction. After being forced by his colleagues to step down last month as Senate Republican leader, Mississippi's Trent Lott says he's been awarded a committee chairmanship for the new session of Congress starting next week. More from NPR's David Wellner.
The man who was to have been the next Senate majority leader told the Associated Press that he will instead be the new chairman of the Senate Rules and Administration Committee. That post was to have been held by the Senate's third-ranking Republican, Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania. Santorum was one of Lott's most ardent defenders when the former leader came under fire for suggesting the country would have done better had Strom Thurmond won a 1948 presidential bid as a segregationist. The Senate GOP caucus chose Tennessee's Bill Frist to replace Lott as incoming majority leader. As rules chairman, Lott will have considerable say over the assignment of prized office space for his colleagues, including those who turned against him amidst the outcry over his racially inflammatory remarks. David Wellner, NPR News, The Capitol.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 6 points to close at 8,601. The Nasdaq gained 2 points. This is NPR News. At least 2 people have been wounded by gunfire in violent street demonstrations in Venezuela's capital. NPR's Martin Costi reports from Caracas.
Thousands of anti-government protesters marched through the middle of Caracas to demand an end to the government of President Hugo Chavez. The protesters were headed toward the gates of the capital's principal military base, where they ran into a group of Chavez supporters armed with stones and bottle rockets. The National Guard and Metropolitan Police drove them apart with tear gas and clubs, and at least 24 people were slightly injured in the resulting stampede. There was also occasional gunfire, but it's unclear where it came from. The streets have calmed down, but there's still a possibility of more violence as members of the opposing groups continue to linger. Venezuela is in the grip of a 5-week-old political strike against Chavez, who's been accused of mismanaging the economy. The president says the strike is a right-wing conspiracy to force him from office. Martin Costi, NPR News, Caracas.
Thousands of demonstrators marched today in Pakistan to protest the presence of American troops in Afghanistan and the possibility of a U.S. attack on Iraq. Some of the protesters burned an effigy of President Bush. The protests in Pakistan's major cities were organized by a coalition of Islamic parties that made big gains in the most recent elections. The turnout was reported to be comparatively small, given that Pakistan is a nation of about 140 million people. Anti-American sentiment in the country was stirred over the weekend after an American soldier was wounded along the Afghan-Pakistan border. U.S. forces called in a warplane to bomb a building where the attacker was believed to be hiding. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results. www.pewtrusts.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. When a person preaches extreme anti-Semitism and sees Jews as the center of an international financial conspiracy, you might presume this person is uneducated, unsophisticated, and easily duped. So how do you explain Henry Ford, one of America's greatest industrialists? While he was building the Ford Motor Company and putting America on the road with his Model T, he was also publishing excerpts of the anti-Semitic book The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. In fact, Hitler became one of his admirers. Neil Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's now out in paperback. Baldwin is the author of earlier biographies of Thomas Alva Edison and William Carlos Williams. Terry spoke with him last January about Henry Ford's racist past. Ford owned the Dearborn Independent, a country newspaper in Dearbornville, Michigan. For 6 months after he bought it, the paper was an all-purpose, feature-oriented publication. But then Ford began to use it as a platform for his anti-Semitic views.
In 1920, he started publishing a series in the Dearborn Independent called The International Jew, The World's Problem. This ran for 91 weeks, this series. What kind of information did he print in this series?
What happened was he had a lieutenant who was the general manager of the Independent, whose name was E.G. Liebold, who was of Prussian-German descent. And Mr. Liebold was a self-styled scholar of anti-Semitism, and he began to assemble a complete library of anti-Jewish literature going back to the 17th century, and Ford gave him a budget, actually, to acquire these works. And at some point in the early 1920, Liebold met a Russian emigre named Boris Brassel, who was an anti-Tsarist who had come to this country to spread the word of anti-Bolshevism. And Brassel had a transcript of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is probably the single most harmful anti-Jewish tract ever created. It was a forgery that had roots in turn-of-the-century Russia around the time of the first Zionist Congress, actually. And it was purportedly, the protocols is another word for minutes, it was purportedly the minutes of a worldwide gathering of the high rabbis gathering in outside Prague at the cemetery of Prague to discuss their plan for world domination. And Brassel was able to get a copy of this into the hands of Liebold. And this tract was serialized in the Dearborn Independent, kind of like each article that attacked a different aspect of the Jewish problem or the Jewish question had an epigraph from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, kind of before the lead paragraph to set the tone for whatever criticism of the Jews was being put forth.
What were some of the main points that the Protocols made about the Jews?
Ford personally resonated so well with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion because the main kind of the informing theme of the protocols was world domination through financial means. The major theme of the protocols is we, being the Jewish people, the Jewish race, as it was called at that time, are going to infiltrate the banks. and we are going to become the wire pullers of the world economy. We are going to become the government behind the government. The way that we are going to subvert the world rulership is through the economic system. And Ford accepted this wholeheartedly because he was so inherently defensive anyway about the Eastern banking establishment and about Wall Street and about the international bankers, the Rothschilds, and the, you know, he had all these generic terms for the, he even thought of J.P. Morgan as part of that that group, and he felt very, very threatened by the banking system.
Can you talk a little bit about the conspiratorial language that was used in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Well, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were written, as I've sort of been implying, they were written in the first person plural. The whole premise of it is that someone was at this secret meeting of these chief rabbis from all around the world, and someone was taking notes and writing down exactly what they were saying. And they kind of took each dimension of society and each dimension of culture in order. So they first discussed the banks, then they discussed another sore spot with Ford, which was the concept of Jews as warmongers. So it would say something like, we are going to instigate the governments of European countries to go to war against each other so that we can then weaken their infrastructure and take over control. The word control was a tremendous buzzword throughout the protocols. And again, you have this sense of solidarity. There's a whole other subtext in the protocols about, which actually sort of in Ford's view paved the way for the Zionist movement, because there's this other section about we are going to establish a country especially for ourselves in Zion, and we will call this country, you know, we will call this country Zion, and we will encourage all Jews to pay homage to this country and to gravitate there, and then we will establish the seat of our world government there. So there's all this kind of sense of solidarity and Jews as one entity, one consistent entity that eventually, en masse, is going to rise up.
What is known about who actually wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
In fact, very little is known. As a matter of fact, to this day, the actual authorship of the protocols is not known. What is known, there's a school of thought that believes that the earlier iteration or roots for the protocols can be traced to the period in France known as the emancipation of, quote-unquote, emancipation of the Jews, which would be the late 18th century. And the second iteration, which is the more concrete and longer-lasting one, came at about 1897, to be exact. And that date happens to coincide with the first Zionist Congress, which took place in Basel, Theodor Herzl, and so forth, which is why many scholars believe that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were put forth to cast aspersions on the Zionist movement. They were put forth as an antidote or as an opposition to the Zionist movement by an anonymous group of writers, anti-Semites, in Tsarist Russia.
Had the protocols spread much before Henry Ford published it, and what was the impact of his publication?
What happened was the articles in the Dearborn Independent, as I say, there were almost 100 of them, and starting in the fall of 1920, Ford began to anthologize these articles into 4 separate pamphlets. Each one had about 20, 25 articles in it. The pamphlets were called, had the overall headline of The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem. These, the earliest publication, 1920, 1921, they found their way over to Germany, and They were published by Theodor Fritsch, who was a virulent anti-Semite in the very early 20s, translated them into German, and they went through 21 printings in 1921 and 1922 alone. They took off like wildfire in Germany, in Munich especially.
So Henry Ford, in a way, helped stir up anti-Semitism in Germany.
If you were a visitor to Adolf Hitler's office in Munich, in the waiting room of Hitler's office, on a sort of low coffee table, was a sort of a display, like spread out, kind of fanned out across the table of the international Jew in the German versions. And then when you were finally welcomed into the inner office, you would find a portrait of Henry Ford on the wall behind Hitler's desk. And this is 1922. This is 16 years before Kristallnacht. In Mein Kampf, he specifically gives credit and admiration to Henry Ford as being the only American. He says there was only one great American, Ford, who understands what we are trying to do here in Germany.
How did Jewish groups respond to Ford's anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitic tracts that he was publishing?
The dialectical nature of this problem was what first sucked me into the exploration in the first place. I felt, as you've just implied, I felt that how would the Jewish leadership go up against somebody of this popularity and this clout, this household name, this brand, actually, human brand in a sense? How to deal with Ford came down to this very essential problem. Do you go up against him in a very aggressive, public way, i.e. petitions, boycotting the purchase of Ford automobiles, letter-writing campaign, telegraphing him, etc.? Do you take the public, aggressive view, or, as Jacob Schiff, the elder statesman of the Jewish community, recommended at the time, do you assume that Ford is a lunatic, quote-unquote, and that, quote, this will pass? And as Jacob Schiff advised his colleagues very strongly, if we go up against Henry Ford, I think he wrote in a letter, this will light a fire that will never be extinguished in our lifetime. We must allow him to essentially burn out and not dignify him with opposition in any way. That was the huge quandary that the American Jewish community faced when Henry Ford started publishing those articles.
Neil Baldwin speaking with Terry Gross. Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's just out in paperback. We'll hear more of their conversation when we return. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews.
How did Ford's public display of anti-Semitism end?
Finally, in the summer of 1927, there was a libel suit brought against Ford in federal district court in Detroit by a man named Aaron Shapiro, who was a former rabbi and an attorney from California, who had actually launched the collective bargaining farming movement in America. He was a pioneer in educating farmers to get together and act in solidarity and help them raise prices and control the flow of their products and so forth. When Ford got wind of Aaron Shapiro's activities, he ordered a series of slanderous articles against him as a Jew daring to infiltrate farming and agriculture, which was a complete anathema to him. And Ford was sued by Shapiro, and the trial commenced, and Ford's lieutenants were called to the stand, and slowly the testimony unfurled, the attribution of Ford being, quote-unquote, the spark plug of the Jewish series, the fact that even though he hadn't written these articles himself, he was the instigation, it was his money, it was his ideas, it was his philosophy. And on the brink of being called to the stand himself, Ford issued a retraction, an apology to the Jewish people, which was drafted by Lewis Marshall, the head of the American Jewish Committee. It was published in hundreds of newspapers through the Hearst syndicate throughout the country. And Ford, you know, essentially settled out of court with Shapiro rather than have to go up and actually talk himself about what he had or had not been doing.
So when Henry Ford issued his retraction, a retraction that was actually written by a leader in the Jewish community, what did the retraction say?
The narrative of the retraction is as if he's saying, first of all, I unwittingly cast aspersions on the general populace of Jews. I didn't really mean to create such a furor by these unprovoked reflections. He admitted that the pamphlets had been distributed in other countries, and he said that those now had his, quote, unqualified disapproval, and that henceforth there would be no more writings against the Jews in the Dearborn Independent. These are points that Lewis Marshall, as an attorney, was trying to score. And once he found out that Ford was going to allow whatever he wrote to be published, he went ahead and covered as many bases as he could. The fact, the historical fact of the matter is that the major premise of this apology, which was the cessation of any further publication, did nothing, of course, to prevent the dissemination of everything that had come before. And Ford actually promised that he would no longer allow the Protocols or the International Jew to be published with his name on it. But since it was never copyrighted by him or by Liebold or Cameron, there was no way that he could enforce that. That's a very important point.
So the Protocols continued to be published, continued to be spread around the world in spite of Henry Ford's repudiation.
That's right.
You know, although after the trial that you discussed, Ford stopped publishing his anti-Semitic tracts, his anti-Semitic influence didn't end there. Would you talk a little bit about what Ford's influence was and what Ford's financial interests were in Nazi Germany?
Hitler sent an emissary to America in the early years before he had even ascended to full power of the Reich. He sent an emissary to this country named Kurt Ludeke, a fundraiser, essentially a fundraiser for the Reich, and he instructed him to be sure and pay a call on Henry Ford. This was in the early 1920s. And Ludeke came to Detroit, and he was able to get a private meeting with Henry Ford. And Ford denied, subsequent to that, that he ever gave funding directly to Nazi Germany or to Adolf Hitler. I think that Ford's support of Hitler is ideological rather than financial. In my research, I was not able to uncover any paper trail directly leading to Hitler from Ford with a financial edge to it. Now, that being said, Henry Ford knew very early on that Germany was a rich, could be a rich potential source for his company. In 1924 and 1925, he already had a factory in place in Berlin and was producing cars over there. And there's no question that for about 15-year period there, Fords were a popular brand in Germany leading up to World War II. That, and again, I must qualify that by saying that many American companies were participating in the economy of Germany at that time. And it's ironic because General Motors actually had a much larger share of the market for the first decade or so that the car companies were American car companies had a presence in Germany. Starting in the earliest years of World War II, however, Ford began to produce materiel and trucks and jeeps and vehicles of a more useful nature to the Germans.
What has Ford done since the death of Henry Ford to make amends for all of the anti-Semitism that Henry Ford was responsible for?
As soon as Henry Ford II took over the chairmanship of the company, which is 1945, Hank the Deuce, as he was known, as he was called by Lee Iacocca and others, he immediately issued various statements and declarations, public pronouncements about the Ford Motor Company position on Jews and its philosophy of equality for all people. And Ford, as a company, was one of the most ardent supporters of the nascent and emerging state of Israel financially, in terms of producing cars over there. And in the 5 or 6 decades since then, there's no question that the Ford family and the Ford Motor Company no longer, you know, has no trace of the legacy of its founder. This was something that began with Henry Ford and ended with Henry Ford. There's no question in my mind about that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Neil Baldwin's book, Henry Ford and the Jews, is just out in paperback. Terry Gross spoke with him last January. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Harcourt, publisher of Jose Saramago's The Cave, An Allegory for Our Times. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the autobiography of a face. We remember writer Lucy Grayley. She died last month at the age of 39. As a child, Grayley had a form of cancer that left her face severely disfigured. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Marriage, a Duet by Anne Taylor Fleming. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Today we remember Lucy Grayley, a writer who died in December. She was 39 years old. The New York Times reported in her obituary that no cause of death was announced. Friends said she'd been despondent over operations she underwent 2 years ago. Grayley was the author of the 1994 memoir Autobiography of a Face, about her experience growing up with extreme facial disfigurement. One critic wrote of the book, "So many memoirs make you feel that you've been sealed up inside a wall with a monomaniac. A really good one, like Autobiography of a Face, makes you feel there's more to ask and learn. You're not just seeing the writer. You're not trying to see yourself. You're seeing the world in a different way." Many of us are dissatisfied when we look in the mirror, but that's very different from the extreme anguish Lucy Grayley experienced when she saw her reflection. By most standards, her face was ugly, even repulsive. Grayley had cancer in her jaw as a child, for which she underwent 5 years of treatment. The surgery and other therapy left her disfigured. Over her lifetime, she had more than 30 reconstructive operations. In her memoir, she wrote that the pain from feeling ugly made cancer seem minor in comparison. Terry spoke with Lucy Grayley in 1994, after the publication of her autobiography. They began with a reading. In this passage, Grayley is a sophomore in college, a year in which she was recuperating from an 8-hour-long reconstructive operation.
While I was in the hospital, I had been so ill that I hadn't put much effort into thinking about my appearance. My mother had been given the use of an apartment on the Upper East Side for the summer, and afterward I went to stay with her. One whole living room wall was covered with mirrors. I walked into the apartment and almost fainted at the sight of me. The graft had been applied not to just one side of my face, but from one ear to the next, and was obscenely swollen to the size of a football. A very large piece of pale skin from my hip had been left in, not just a small patch like the last time. This strip was 1 foot long and 4 inches wide, and on either side of it were long rows of sutures. If feeling like a freak had been more in my mind than in my face at other times in my life, the visage I saw now staring back at me was undeniably repulsive. The feeling was confirmed for me whenever I went out on the street. People would stop in their tracks and stare at me. One afternoon, a beggar ran up behind me, demanding money. I stopped and turned around to look at him. He stopped in mid-sentence, looked at me for a minute longer, then politely apologized and handed me a dollar bill before turning away, muttering to himself. My self-esteem reached the bottom of the deepest, darkest pit.
Lucy, I'd like you to describe what your face looks like now.
It's funny you say that, and my immediate reaction is to sort of give you my opinion of my face rather than my actual face. Like, I could say, well, it's a nice face, or it's a this face. I mean, if I were to be strictly
clinical
about it, most of the upper half of my face is quite normal. I have a slight swelling on my left eyelid from a lot of surgery, which has blocked the lymph drainage, but it's not very noticeable. I have slightly, they're not buck teeth, but you can see my teeth in a way that you wouldn't necessarily if it weren't for the fact that my lower lip is a little bit collapsed on the left side. There's a patch of white skin on the right side of my face, which is covering a small defect in the bone where two different bone grafts on either side of my face join up, and they join up slightly imperfectly. So there's a slight lopsidedness to my lower jaw. There's something distinctly odd about it. If you were to see me, you would definitely know that something had happened to me. Then we start getting into the more subjective accounts of what my face looks like. There would be many times in my life when I would just have simply answered that question by saying, I'm ugly. Now I'm willing to concede that my face is actually quite interesting, and not only interesting, but I think there are aspects of it which I find quite attractive. And that sounds like some kind of result of a lifelong self-help program, but it isn't. It's more to do with finally, at the age of 31, conceding that there is no one specific face to which I should be aspiring. I think my relationship to my face changes a lot, although perhaps not quite as much as it was when I was younger. In my book, I say at one point that I was unable to distinguish between saying I'm depressed and I'm ugly, because the two had become completely linked in my mind. I really did not know the difference. And I'm really just like anybody else. I have days where I wake up and I think, oh, God. And then other days I look in the mirror and I think, you know, hey, you know, I don't look so bad.
Your cancer was diagnosed when you were in fourth grade.
Yes.
And you missed most of fourth grade and fifth grade between surgery and chemotherapy and then radiation. And you write during that period you really felt most comfortable when you were in the hospital.
I loved the hospital.
Why did you love it there?
I felt very, I think we just love the familiar, you know, even when the familiar is objectively unpleasant or even horrible. I'm a very independent person, and I liked my independence at the hospital. I didn't feel like I had to answer to anybody. And a lot of my suffering was emotional suffering. I mean, there was a definite physical side to it. There was a large physical side to it. But I saw that as rather easy in compared to the sort of emotional assault of guilt and shame that I was continuously throwing upon myself. And I never felt the need to do that in the hospital. It was like a refuge.
What did your face look like then?
Oh, it changed weekly, practically, which is part of the you know, really the story and the dilemma. It's not really so much, my story is not so much a story about being disfigured. It's really about having a face that changed so continuously that I never really identified myself as connected to it. And the easiest moments in my life have been, or rather the most damaging moments in my life have been that easy fall into saying, I'm ugly, just like defining it and closing the door on it that way, rather than looking at the fact that my face was different almost continuously. And that I actually had, I put off developing that sort of social sense that most people have to come to terms with. On the other hand, I always was able to feel special. I never had that familiar adolescent worry of fading into the crowd. I was special, and I tried to use that to my advantage, and I tried to use it as a power almost over other people.
I found it interesting when you were young and your chemotherapy treatments were ending. This must have been still in grade school. You were almost afraid of them ending because you wouldn't be special anymore.
I think, too, that has to do with the familiar, like the love of the familiar. It was what I knew. And it also, I was very intent on trying to be brave all the time. Like, I really wanted to be brave so that my family would recognize my lovability, because I was always worried that, you know, that they didn't love me and that they would only love me if I could somehow personally take on this task and prove my worthiness. And I was afraid that if I were having chemotherapy, then there would be nothing to, no place in which I could distinguish myself in that way.
What has your relationship with mirrors been over the years? Have there been periods when you've looked and periods when you didn't want to look, periods when you liked to have mirrors around and periods when you avoided them?
It's really alternated. There have been a lot of times when I've been fascinated by my image and I'll just stare at it sort of endlessly. And both, you know, we all have those mirror faces that we see each other adopting when we stand in front of the mirror, look in front of the mirror. And I would do that a lot throughout different periods of my life. There was a time when I spent almost an entire year not looking in a mirror, which was very difficult. It really was not very easy to do, to avoid my image. I had no idea how many times you see your own reflected image. I mean, it really is very constant once you become aware of it. It's almost like when you're dieting, that you become aware of how many people are eating around you. And I suddenly became aware of, like, how many reflective surfaces there were. And I stopped looking because I was having something called a tissue expander, which is this very bizarre process where they put a balloon under your cheek and very slowly inflate it with a saline solution over a period of several months so as to stretch out the skin, so that then when they remove it, they'll have skin to cover whatever bone or muscle graft they're going to put in. So I was having one of those, and I was walking around looking like I had a balloon under my face. It was very bizarre. I mean, it got so absurd that I started to feel like I was in some strange kind of myth or story or something. And it it just sort of went on. I couldn't bring myself to look. Even after the tissue expander had been taken out, I couldn't bring myself to look. So I just didn't. And even after, you know, that problem was solved, I kept not looking and I kept not looking. And it actually led to one of the greatest revelations in my life, is because I was sitting with somebody a long time later, you know, like a year after not doing this, and it suddenly occurred to me, I was with this man that I was actually attracted to, and I wondered what I looked like to him. And I realized that I really had absolutely no idea of what I looked like, because I had not looked in a mirror for so long. And I realized that it was an almost prehistoric state, because there is almost nobody in the world who does not know what they look like. It just doesn't happen. And I realized that most of the time when I'm with somebody, I'm looking at myself for them. I have this idea of what I look like.
Right.
And I hand it over to them, and then I look only for the negative ways in which they would sort of reflect it back at me. And that was the very first time in my life that I literally had no image of what I looked like to hand over to somebody. I really just had no idea what he saw when he saw me.
Do you remember the first time at the end of that year when you did look in a mirror?
I did it sort of surreptitiously. I didn't like march on up to a mirror. I kind of like looked. At that moment, I looked into the window behind them, because it was in Scotland, and at Scotland it gets dark at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was already dark. So I looked back and I could see the whole like cafe that we were sitting in sort of sitting behind me, and I could see the back of his head, and I could see my hair. And I just like sort of dazed my eyes. So I kind of saw my head, or the shape of my head and my hair, without actually looking at my face, and I gradually let it sort of sink in. I let my eyes focus and rest on my own face. And I was actually, you know, I wouldn't say I was pleasantly surprised, but it was me. It was really like the first time that I thought, oh, that's me. How interesting.
Lucy Grayley from a 1994 interview with Terry Gross. Grayley died last month at the age of 39. Her memoir is Autobiography of a Face. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're featuring a 1994 interview with writer Lucy Grayley, author of the memoir Autobiography of a Face, about growing up with extreme facial disfigurement. Grayley died last month at the age of 39.
You know, I found it interesting you described how sometimes you'd be walking down the street and, you know, a guy would whistle at you. He'd see you from behind.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're thin and you had long hair, and he'd whistle, and then you'd turn around and he'd see your face, and what would happen?
Well, usually it would depend. If he was by himself, it would just get quiet. If they were a group of people, or men, because it was always men, it would, sometimes they would say things to each other, like nasty things, like, oh, go ask her on a date, in this very sort of teasing way. That was very damaging, because ultimately that was about sex and about sexuality. That wasn't just making fun of the way I looked. It's one thing to be called, I don't know, there are many disparaging terms that we call each other, relate either in men to any kind of like power or potency. Like that's what you, if you want to get a man, you say something about him being a wimp or something like that. With a woman, like you often refer to her sexuality, whether you call her, you know, some term for a prostitute or some term as for somebody who's undesirable, like ugly. I was called ugly a lot. And that was a direct assault on my sexuality, or my lack of it, as it was perceived.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the face is a sexual organ in the sense that that's where you kiss,
mm-hmm.
and you use the mouth to make love. I mean, your disfigurement was very connected to probably how people saw you sexually.
I think so. I mean, yeah, it definitely was.
And to how you saw yourself sexually.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't I was a late bloomer, as I say. I was convinced I would be a virgin for my entire life. I just sort of gave myself over to it in this martyr kind of way.
You write your only solution to dealing with your face was to stop caring, so you became pretentious.
I was very pretentious. Some people would say I still was, but I won't go into that.
So what was your brand of pretension?
Oh, I was going to be the noble seeker of truth and beauty. And I thought that if I was never going to get, you know, love with a lowercase L or be beautiful with a lowercase B, then I was going to find out about beauty with a capital B, you know, through art and life and nature, and find out about love as, you know, like some sort of, I think I was on some kind of a spiritual quest for a long time. I mean, I still am, but in those days, it started out as a protective mode. You know, gradually, luckily, miraculously, it became more, it left the realm of mere sort of defense, and it became a genuine journey, but it was spawned out of just fear of the world. I wasn't rejecting the world because I disdained it. I was rejecting the world because I feared that it would reject me.
You went to out-of-town college. I assume you were still feeling very uncomfortable sexually then, too. And you're right, you had a close friend who was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And he started taking you to the gay clubs, which must have been a very interesting experience for you because the gay clubs were very much about sexuality, but it wasn't a sexuality you were part of.
Yeah, it had really nothing to do with me, but I was so closely aligned with it. And I think even at the time, I didn't realize that this was how I was exploring the issue without any danger to me whatsoever. You know, I didn't even recognize that. I never would have associated myself with any kind of, like, you know, mere seeking of earthly pleasures as it was. And it was really only recently when I was at another gay club. I went to a gay club someplace, you know, and there were like just all these like half-naked men gyrating around me. And I thought, you know, Lucy, you twit, like how could you not think that that had anything to do with sex back then? You know, when it had a lot to do with sex, just not necessarily my own.
Do you think writing is at all connected to becoming very inward during the years that you were so self-conscious?
I think I would have been a writer or some kind of an artist, probably a writer anyway. I think what being sick did was it afforded me two very interesting things. One was the opportunity to lie very still and think a lot. Even when one is, you know, sort of imprisoned by other physical means, one still reads or watches TV or whatever, or is distracted. And there are a lot of times when I couldn't read or watch television even because I really just felt so ill. So I had a lot of time to lie around and think. And I think that was very valuable. What I also had was this disease, as we were talking about in the very beginning, that was not just physical, but was very much emotional. And I suffered a lot physically, and I would go through all kinds of different ways of thinking and ways of viewing the world and this and that, all kinds of philosophies to try and like not make myself suffer as much physically. And sometimes I would succeed. I would like forget my physical suffering for a while. And it would be incredibly joyous. Like I experienced true joy. You know, meanwhile, emotionally, you know, you can have very good days where you're thinking very positively, everything seems very good, and then you have some kind of a relapse where you're just convinced that everything is horrible, you know, your life's going down the toilet and you're not going anywhere. And the worst thing about that is that you then also can very easily be seduced into thinking that just the other day when you were thinking so positively about life, you were deluding yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually negate something that happened in the past. Whereas opposed to pain, you know, if I wasn't suffering, I simply was not suffering. Whereas the complexity of emotional suffering is that even when you're not suffering, you can believe that you're suffering. And it was almost like a testing ground. Like I was able to find out through, like when I was very sick with the chemotherapy, I would be ill and ill and ill for days and days. And then there would be this brief moment where I would know that I was going to get better. And I would feel this profound joy. And then in the next moment, I would feel very ill again. But that illness was somehow different. It was not necessarily lesser than the illness I had been feeling before that moment when I knew I would get well. But it was a physical feeling that was suffused with this knowledge that it was an impermanent state. And I had enough time to lie around and think and realize that it was this knowledge which changed the way I suffered, which alleviated my suffering. And it was a knowledge that had to do with just simply moving forward into the next moment and being very honest and not dragging my fear of suffering, because it's the fear of suffering which we suffer from far more than actual physical ailments themselves. And I transferred that onto sort of the emotional plane, and I realized that a lot of my emotional suffering came about from fearing, like sort of taking fears that were accrued in the past and projecting them into the future, like an unforeseen future.
Lucy Grayley speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Her memoir is Autobiography of a Face. Lucy Grayley died last month. She was 39. Coming up, Marriage, a Duet. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Ann Taylor Fleming is known for her on-air essays on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and as a contributor to Newsnight with Aaron Brown. Now she's published her first work of fiction, a pair of novellas called Marriage, a Duet. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
My New Year's resolution was to be less judgmental, an admirable way to live, but a stupid way to read. Accordingly, last week I spent way too much time embracing big chunks of mediocre to bad new books, trying to convince myself there was something to like in each of them. I started with the fat new novel by a master nonfiction writer who shouldn't write novels, abandoned that book for an earnest first novel with a weak voice, and then moved on to a new agey travelogue whose zen pointlessness irritated rather than soothed me. By the time I stumbled onto Ann Taylor Fleming's two novellas, collectively called Marriage, a Duet, I was worn out from the effort to be affirming. That's when Fleming's writing reminded me that when a book is genuinely good, falling in love doesn't take work. Staying in love, however, that's another matter, as Fleming herself demonstrates. Both of these smart, sexually frank, and tightly constructed novellas are about solid marriages that have been cracked by infidelity. In the first, called A Married Woman, the fracture is decades old but still noticeable, so to speak, on X-rays. The novella opens in a hospital room where an older woman named Caroline Betts attends her comatose husband William's bedside. She's joined sporadically by her two middle-aged children, Kate, a no-nonsense lawyer, and Stephen, a restaurant owner. Kate and Stephen are shaken by the fact that their mother, instead of growing haggard during her vigil, has gotten prettier. Her clothes are stylish, she's wearing more makeup, and one afternoon in the hospital bathroom, she even dyes her gray hair brown. What they don't know is that Caroline irrationally wants to make herself look good in anticipation of the deathbed reappearance of William's mistress, a younger woman for whom decades ago, stalwart William came very, very close to leaving Caroline. In supple language that delights because of its surprising shifts in mood, Fleming captures the terror and tedium of the hospital, and she makes readers understand how Caroline, while steeling herself for the ultimate abandonment of death, would be overwhelmed by memories of William's earlier near abandonment of her. There's also an element of gallows humor here, as when Caroline looks down on her formerly noisy, opinionated, and garrulous husband and takes some pleasure in the fact that he's been permanently silenced. But humor, in all its ghastlier shadings, really comes to the fore in the second superb novella, A Married Man, in which a youngish, successful financial advisor named David Sanderson takes a psychological nosedive after his wife Marcia confesses to a quickie bout of car sex with one of his clients. Then she matter-of-factly expects forgiveness. Meditating on Marcia's emotional efficiency, David goes off on this riff. This was the new breed of women. Never before in the history of the world had so many women been so competent at so many things. They had their careers and their babies. They were gourmet cooks and self-aware lovers. They could do the carving and the barbecuing. Where had they come from? He thought of his own mother. She was from a whole different species of women, from a whole other planet, the planet of the aprons, of the perennially overcooked pork chops, of the intractable postpartum pounds, of the public and no doubt private prudery. She and her friends got old young. Marcia and her friends were determined to be young old. David is a mess and fights for his right to be one with the therapist he and Marcia are seeing, an adultery counselor who's made a fortune by writing about his own adulterousness. It's easy to take cheap shots at therapy, and through David, Fleming gleefully takes them here. She also captures the antic joy of small children. David and Marcia have two little boys, the physical symptoms of heartbreak, and the strain of living with open-endedness. Both of Fleming's novellas, but particularly the second, reminded me of the greatest novella I've ever read about adultery, Jane Smiley's The Age of Grief. By virtue of their wit and emotional power, Fleming's novellas deserve a coveted perch near Smiley's shady literary company.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Marriage, a Duet by Anne Taylor Fleming. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Shurock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Niagara Falls All Over Again by Elizabeth McCracken, author of A Giant's House. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the stop-motion animator Ray Harryhausen. His films include The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts. Also, a conversation with the creators of the original reality show, An American Family. Join us for the next Fresh Air.